Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. Today we continue a special series of recordings that will encourage and inspire your walk with Christ. I'm reading a book written in 1965 by Chohu Ah, a mining engineer in 1940s Korea, during the early days of communism. Chohu tells how he suffered with Christ and his people in those chaotic times, even as so many still suffer today. The book is called Decision at Dawn, and we're on chapter 8, entitled Flight. Spring had ripened into summer. Every day now the sirens wailed, and almost every day the UN bombers rained death on the city. Out here in the residential area, I didn't feel threatened, for the pilots saved their cargo of death to drop on the factories near the Taedong River. If the police had been around looking for me, I was not aware of it. But the very fact that I was safe, while others were in danger, left me in a constant state of restless dissatisfaction. One hot day in early July, quite early in the morning, I was awakened by unfamiliar voices. I had padlocked the door to my room, which opened into the compound, and also nailed it shut to give the impression that the room was unoccupied. Also, I had cut a peephole through which I could observe the compound. Pushing aside the rice paper flap, I could see that Mr. Park was being interrogated by a stooped, skinny man with a twitch. He held a list in his hand on which he was checking off names. From his action, and from what Mr. Park had told me, I guessed the visitor was Myung Yul-suk, inspector of our barn. Yul-suk, according to Mr. Park, ran a chemist shop a few doors down the street, where he dispensed roots, herbs, and nostrums according to ancient formulas dating back hundreds of years. Yul-suk was typical of certain clerks and tradesmen who, in order to ensure their own safety, had become inspectors for the party and informed on their neighbors. Yul-suk pointed toward my door. Mr. Park shook his head. I could not hear what either had been saying, but I was quite certain now that I could expect an official visit from the police. Quite naturally, this was the first thought that came to me when, shortly after sunrise, 3 days later, I heard a light knocking at my door. My forehead broke out in a dew of sweat. My hand trembled as I pushed aside the paper flap. And there, to my amazement, stood not the police, but Mother.
Chohu! Chohu-ya! Chohu, my son!
Shh, Mother! I mustn't open this door. Move away from it as quickly as you can. Go along the wall till you come to the corner, where you'll find the kitchen. I'll meet you there.
I slipped out and down the passageway. Mother was standing there looking so small and delicate in that big expanse. We took each other's hands. Mother started to ask me why I hadn't let her in by the front door, but I put my finger to my lips and beckoned her to follow me. Only when we were safe in my room did I tell her how glad I was to see her and what it meant to have her here. I pulled out cushions from the cabinet for us to sit on. Then the questions poured forth. I wanted to know about Father's health, whether Changhua had found a school, and if things were going well with the inn. It touched my heart to think that Mother had braved the bombings to see how I was getting along. I couldn't help being amused that she expressed so little concern over the possibility that a bomb might hit me or that I might be seized by the police. Rather, she was worried over whether I was eating properly and getting enough exercise. What would she think, I wondered, if she knew I was planning to work with the underground? I told her that I was still planning to escape to the south, as I thought that would make her feel better. I tried my best not to let her know how lonely my life was, and talked a great deal about what we were doing at the church. Her worry over my eating was eased somewhat when I surprised her that evening with a 5-course supper I had prepared myself. It consisted of soybean soup, kimchi, 2 dishes of cooked vegetables, and salted fish. I could hardly stop talking after having been so long by myself. I was delighted when Mother told me she could remain for several days. Mr. Park had kindly offered her a room. Well, midsummer was upon us. Mother and I liked to sit out in the compound under the peach tree, enjoying the warm weather and looking through the family album. We were talking together, as usual, on the third morning of her visit, when someone banged noisily at the gate. Mr. Park hurried to open it, and in came Yulsuk. Mother and I sat rooted to our bench. It was too late to leave. Mr. Park and Yulsuk talked in low tones. Again, Yulsuk gestured toward my door. The moment I dreaded had come. I would now be asked why I wasn't in the army, and what job I was doing for North Korea and for the party. Yulsuk started toward us across the compound, moving with slow deliberation like an automaton. He stopped, peered at Mother and me, executed a kind of quick, jerky movement intended, no doubt, to pass for a bow, and said, "Are you in peace?" "I am in peace," Mother replied. "I hope you are in peace." "I am the inspector, Banjang," he went on. He turned to me. "How is it that I do not have your name?" "Well, I am not surprised, Banjang Nim," I said. Nim is an honorary salutation, used when addressing someone of rank. "My work has taken me from the city. I have only recently returned." "And what is this work you speak of?" I fumbled for my engineering certificate. My hesitation must have frightened Mother, for she smiled at him and broke in with her soft, melodious voice. "You must be very busy, Banjang Nim, having so many people to keep an eye on." Her smile had softened him. He smiled in return. Then his mellow look was replaced by a harsher one. Two sides of his character were struggling for mastery. "There isn't much to it, madam. The party thinks of everything. One has but to fill out the forms complete and be sure to make no mistakes." When it came to party matters, he could express himself only in party phrases. Then the mellow look showed again, indicating that he recognized in Mother a lady, a fellow human being, one whom he might have served in his chemist's shop. It is hard on the feet, though. One must make the rounds at least twice a day, sometimes thrice. Mother was touched by having elicited this human response, however brief, from such a mechanical robot. Tears glistened in her eyes. "Banjang Nim," she cried out on impulse, "you're a kind man. I beg of you, take good care of my son." Well, the brief glow of humanity faded. The robot emerged again. "If he behaves like a good party member, all will go well. Otherwise..." He let the unfinished sentence carry its own implication, but before he turned to walk out the gate, he bowed low, showing true deference to Mother. All the while his face remained impassive. If I could only read his thoughts! But at least he had so little suspicion of me that he hadn't asked to see either my engineer's certificate or my citizenship papers. The sun, now high overhead, was hot. No air raid sirens whined today. After Mother had served the midday meal, we went back to our bench under the little peach tree. We hadn't been there long until another knocking came, a series of light taps. It was our signal in the underground. I hurried to open the gate before Mr. Park could come to his door. As I had expected, the two visitors were both members of our secret executive committee. Choi Pyong-san, the electrical engineer who had inducted me, with him was An Byung-ho, the secretary of the group, pale, thin, and scholarly, with longish hair. Pyong-san had taken me often to Byung-ho's bookstore, where those in the movement left messages for one another. Again I was struck by how much Pyong-san resembled me, and a feeling of uneasiness came over me as I realized that he must have passed the chemist's shop on his way to Mr. Park's. Since Ban Mai Ling was now on the alert, he could hardly have escaped the inspector's attention. I motioned my two guests inside and closed the gate quickly.
"You mustn't stay," I said. "The inspector of the Ban just left. I expect him back at any moment."
Byung San and the secretary exchanged worried glances. "We've got to talk to you," said Byung San. "Things are coming to a head. The war is going against the Reds. The moment is coming to put our plans into effect."
"Very well, then," I said with some nervousness. "Quick, follow me."
I suggested to Mother that she take up a position in front of Mr. Park's door. If anyone appeared, she was to call to me. I led the two men through the kitchen and along the passageway to my back door. Peng San had brought me my copy of the Constitution. I put it in the drawer, where I kept my citizenship certificate. Then we got down to business. For the first time, I was made aware of the size and efficiency of the underground. There were at least 250 members here in Pyongyang. The thoroughness of the program astonished me. The objective was no less than to cripple the Red Army around Pyongyang as soon as their forces began to retreat. The plans were too secret to be set down on paper. Speaking in a low voice, Byung San ticked them off to me. We were to set dynamite charges in the large factories, blow up the key bridges, and do exposed sweeps of roads with machine gun fire. But this involves mass killing and the slaughter of innocent people. As a Christian, I protest. But the others were in no mood to listen. My words were as chaff in the wind. They wanted to get on with the job. But Pyung San, being a reasonable man, at least got out his copy of the Constitution and tried to show me his interpretation. We were heatedly discussing it when we heard noises that made us hold our breath. First came a banging on the gate, even louder than before. Next, the patter of Mr. Park's feet as he crossed to open up. Then the creaking of the big hinges. Finally, Mother's voice crying out to warn me. I jumped to the peephole. Three soldiers, followed by two men in civilian clothes, were marching into the compound. Yulsuk was not with them. I didn't know whether to take this as a good or bad omen, but one thing I did know, we had to get out fast. The older of the two men in plain clothes was giving the orders. He posted one soldier inside the gate. The second he dispatched toward my room. I became really frightened when I saw the third one moving toward the kitchen. He could block our avenue of escape. The man paid no attention to Mother. Before anyone noticed her, she had slipped out the front gate. What in heaven's name, I said to myself, is she thinking of? Just before she disappeared, the leader spotted her and shouted to one of the soldiers to go after her. I turned to my friends to explain how I proposed to get them out of there. "I'll go ahead," I told them. "When we reach the kitchen, I'll divert the attention of the guard and run to the right. You, then, run to the left down the alley. When you come to the third gate on the downtown side, knock like this." I showed them the prearranged signal. "A friend of mine lives there. She'll open up for you." I stopped and turned back to the peephole. A commotion had broken out in the compound. Both soldiers and plainclothesmen were running about aimlessly and yelling. Confusion reigned inside my room as well. Byung-ho, a scholar and philosopher, was edgy and anxious to get started. Byung-san, the man of action, asked me to rehearse the plan once more to be sure we understood it properly. I was trying to see some pattern in the commotion outside when I heard Mother's voice. It came from the window that opened on the alley. She was calling my name. Then I heard the shouts of soldiers. Mother, in trying to save me, had let the police know that I was in my room. Motioning to the others to follow me, I ran for the kitchen. Mother's cries had drawn the soldiers to that part of the alley which went off to the right. Now they would block my planned escape route. I slowed down, ready to change my direction, when I saw that no one was watching the kitchen. My two friends had caught up with me by now. All three of them whistled to the left, made a dash for it down the alley with me. At the third gate, I was raising my fist to
to give the signal when I saw that it was unlocked. It opened easily. The others slipped in first. I was about to drop the bar again when I spotted the three soldiers running after us. I heard a startled exclamation. The young housewife from the church choir was taking some washing from the clothesline. She led us through her house and then out into the backyard on the other side, across another alley and into the house of a neighbor. The neighbor, a young woman in her late 20s, appeared suddenly at her door. She was frightened at the sight of us and not quite sure what to do.
"Let them go through your house. Out through your backyard. Please, hurry," my friend pleaded.
The woman barred our way, standing there, as though unable to move. I decided to be frank with her.
"We're escaping from the police. Please help us."
Sympathy conquered her fears. She nodded to us to follow her. We went through her house, out her front gate, and found ourselves in another alley. This one ended up against a brick wall at the far end, but opened onto a busy thoroughfare at the other. We ran as hard as we could until we reached the thoroughfare. Then, guided only by instinct, we started in the direction which we thought would take us to the busiest section of Pyongyang, where we would hope to lose ourselves in the crowd. Changing our pace to an easy, ambling walk, we tried to look as much as possible like three young workers homeward bound from the day shift in a factory. Pyongsan nudged me. About 100 meters ahead was a red brick building with a familiar green lamp that indicated a police post. We kept on, looking neither right nor left as we passed, half expecting a command to halt. We'd gone another 200 meters when I shot a glance at Pyongsan. In spite of the changes in my appearance, we still looked enough alike to be twins. This wasn't good. Any informer who might notice us together would remember us. I slowed to a stop. So did the others. I tried to make it look as though we were having a casual discussion there on the sidewalk. "Look," I said, "the alarm will soon be out for us. It's better than even odds that we were noticed when we passed the police post. We must split up," they both agreed. "We'll meet again at the bookshop, whenever we can. So long, and good luck." We went our separate ways. I wasn't worried about either of them. Pyongsan had a hiding place in his attic. Byung had one in the rear of his bookstore. They had only to reach their home. As for myself, the prospects were not so bright. It would be suicide to go back to Mr. Park's. The police had probably ambushed the place right now, hoping I'd do just that. I walked along. The only relative I might reach was a second cousin who lived in the suburbs. If Mother got away, that's where she'd go. That's where I'd go now. To reach him, I'd have to cross the Taedong with two tight security checks on the bridge. Well, so be it. It was late in the afternoon. A cold drizzle was falling. I welcomed it, for it might dampen the enthusiasm of the search. The sooner I got over the bridge, the better. As I approached it, I reached instinctively into my pocket for my citizenship papers. I stiffened in horror. My fingers came away empty. In the haste and confusion with which we had fled from my room, I had left my identification behind. But worse, we had also forgotten to take with us the Constitution of the Underground. My citizenship certificate was lying in the same drawer with that most incriminating of documents. What damning evidence! How it would please Chung Bong Shun when he knew. How it would intensify his search for me. From that moment I knew what it was to be a hunted man. Every pair of eyes seemed to be looking at me with suspicion. Every man, woman, and child hurrying along the streets was a potential informer. I wanted to cross the Taedong at the rush hour. I'd forgotten all time. Now I looked at my wrist. It was empty. I left my watch behind as well. I waited until the crowd built up. I passed in such a crush that no one asked for my citizenship papers, but I wondered, would I be so lucky another time?
I went as fast as possible to my relatives. Mother had not been there. My relative was not particularly pleased to see me. He was having some trouble with the police, but he did give me a few won to tide me over, as I'd also left my money behind. There was nothing to do but go on back to Pyongyang. Perhaps I'd seek another hausuk, a not-too-pleasant prospect. Situated close to the industrial section, it would be vulnerable to bombing. I had memorized the address of the jeweler who bought gold from Father. He lived behind his shop. Perhaps he could put me up for the night. The rain came down harder. Darkness was closing in. I was drenched, but at least the rainstorm gave the illusion of protection. I found the shop. The windows, however, were dark. The jeweler was gone. I assumed he had fled the city to escape the bombings. I would have to look elsewhere. Then I recalled that a plant which another cousin of mine, Hyun Lin, supplied with rice straw rope, was only 3 kilometers from the bridge. With luck, I might catch Cousin Lin at the factory, for he often delivered the shipments himself. If not, someone might know his whereabouts. Aside from what my relative had given me, I had no money. It was important to me, therefore, that I see Cousin Lin. Since he was a businessman who was doing well for himself, he should be able to lay hands on some cash. I found the factory without any trouble and went straight to the manager's office, where I learned Cousin Lin was expected that same evening. The men on the night shift were about to sit down to their supper. The manager invited me to eat with them. Afterward, he took me on a quick tour of the plant, which turned out in quantity the same kind of wire for the army that Pyongsan made on a small scale in his attic workshop. But this was a large factory. Uniformed guards were everywhere, keeping close watch to prevent sabotage. I felt a certain ease of mind in knowing that the guards, having seen me with the manager, would accept me without question. Again I thought of the old saying, "Under the lamp it is darkest." I was temporarily safe right here under the communist nose. Cousin Lin showed up about 9:30. He seemed pleased to see me. I took him aside and told him straight off that I needed some money. In fact, quite a good deal of money. "How much?" he asked. 100,000 won. That's about 500 American dollars at that time. He whistled. "Why do you need so much?" "I want to go to the south." "Well, let me check with the manager. I came down with quite a good-sized shipment. Maybe he can pay me for it." He was gone for some time. "He can't get it tonight," Cousin Lin said when he finally returned. "Do you have any place to stay?" I shook my head. "In that case, you can sleep right here on the floor of the factory. Many of the men live in the country, but they'd rather stay here at night than travel back and forth." He spoke to the foreman, who came back in a few minutes with a mokchim. The men stretched out on their tatami mat and mokchins. They made room for me. It was much like the prison cell at Yongchin, but we had plenty of space in which to sleep. In the morning, I ate breakfast with the men on the day shift. I couldn't leave until I had my money, but Cousin Lin was nowhere to be seen. Shortly after 10, I heard the mournful, low-pitched signals of the first alert. The second alert followed immediately on the heels of the first, which was most unusual. It meant that UN planes had already been sighted within our borders. Seconds later, we heard the planes coming. We were under orders to take cover during a raid. All of a sudden, I had an urge to watch the planes as they passed. Instead of going to the bomb shelter, I ran for a flight of stairs leading to a balcony at the front of the plant. From there, I had an unobstructed view. While I watched, one group of B-29 bombers dropped their clusters on the industrial suburbs of Pyongyang far to the west. There was a deafening roar. Other planes were so directly over my head that I had to lean out beyond the overhang to see. They sounded like medium bombers. I must have counted at least 30 of them. The first bomb fell no more than 1 kilometer away. I couldn't make it to the shelter now. I'd have to stay where I was.
I crouched in a corner under the overhang, thrust my thumbs into my ears, covered my eyes with my fingers, and opened my mouth, as our Japanese instructors had taught us in high school. Bombs fell all around me with a heavy thunk, thunk. I prayed fervently, God, keep me in your breast, keep me, keep me. Boom, boom, boom. Three bombs hit and exploded almost as one. The shock wave was so intense that I couldn't breathe. My ribs ached. I thought my chest would burst. Slowly, the pressure eased. I drew a shallow breath in the choking dust. My eyes, forced open, began to smart. The dust started me coughing. I held a handkerchief over my eyes and nose. Ahead of me were the hazy outlines of distant factory buildings. I didn't remember that I had been able to see them before. I looked down at my feet. I was leaning against the wall near the top of the stairs. The shock had moved me some 3 meters from the corner where I had been crouching. Aghast, on that spot was a pile of rubble, topped by hunks of plaster and heavy tiles. Surely my prayers had been answered. I stood there in a stupor, trying to comprehend the miracle of my escape. Slowly, a familiar voice registered on my mind, although it sounded far off. Chula! Chula! Can you hear me, Chula? The voice became clearer. It was my cousin's. He had come out of the bomb shelter, looking for me before the all-clear sounded. I answered him weakly and groped my way down the stairs. Through the dense clouds of dust, Cousin Lin stood silhouetted in the shelter doorway. I bolted for it as though someone were pursuing me. The sill tripped me and sent me sprawling on the floor inside. I lay in a limp heap, trying to collect my thoughts. Cousin Lin sat down beside me. "I'm sure that you were saved by God," he murmured. "No one could have lived through such an explosion without divine intervention." "I was praying," I said, "when I was out there on the balcony." And then with a natural reaction, he began to scold me. "Never go out in an air raid on your own like that again." The men who had been so boisterous in their loud conversations were quiet, awed by my extraordinary delivery. In the silence, I could hear the sirens sending out their shrill signals. The lips of the men moved silently as they counted the pulses. Honk, honk. A minute's stillness, then the same thing all over again. The early warnings were being reversed from most to least dangerous, leading to the all clear. Anxious to see what damage had been done, I went back upstairs to the balcony. I moved gingerly out to the edge, for the railing was no longer there. At least half of the house, which used to be across the street, was gone, sliced straight down on one side into a deep bomb crater. No more than 100 meters away was another crater. Along the street to the left, dead bodies were lying helter-skelter like rag dolls, tossed away by a thoughtless child. Arms, legs, torsos. It was the first time that I had seen what a bombing can do. I was numb. Sorrow and pity for these unfortunates tore my heart as I went back down to the street. Who were they? What were they? Single, like myself? Married? Leaving a family behind them? Alone and unprotected? Why had their wives and their lives been taken? Not mine. Hearing the cry of a small child, I squinted through the dusty air. A little boy, about a year old, was sitting on the ground beside his dead mother. The explosion had torn away her clothing. Her breasts were exposed, and the child was leaning over, trying to suckle. After a few seconds, he reared back and let out a wail, then returned to his efforts. I picked him up and tried to comfort him. I expected he would be frightened of a stranger, but he clutched me desperately around the neck. I stood for a long time holding him, singing a nursery rhyme from my childhood.
The baby clung to me. His tiny body shook with deep sighs. A man came toward me out of the haze. His face was bloody. At the sight of the boy, he uttered a moan and held out his arms. I handed over the child. Nothing was said. There seemed to be nothing to say. I walked off, an ache in my stomach. What will that man do without his wife? I wondered. How will he care for such a little one and still work? Are there other older children? Why must we have such wars to bring destruction and sorrow to the innocent and defenseless? I continued on, only dimly comprehending what I saw. On the sidewalk in front of me lay the bloody stump of a man's leg, still clothed in its trouser, with a shoe on the foot. Mechanically, I stooped and picked it up. Across the street, I found a mangled corpse with matching trouser. I deposited the leg gently beside it. A fire truck, its siren screaming, burst around the corner. The shock of sound cleared my head. I started as though awakening from a nightmare. Ahead of me was a third bomb crater. For the first time, I understood the phenomenon which had saved me. The three bombs must have exploded simultaneously. The concussion of each in the triangular pattern, neutralizing the concussion of the other two. A second's difference in the timing in the factory where I had been standing would have been leveled. I felt dizzy. Again, I wondered why I had been spared against such great odds. I was groping for some reason, some purpose, when I heard Cousin Lin calling me. He came running up. "I've been searching everywhere for you. I'm so glad I found you. The manager got orders to move the plant, bag and baggage, machinery and raw materials, over to the northwest. We go tomorrow. I was afraid I might lose you." My heart skipped a beat. I didn't like the prospect of being left on my own with no money. On the other hand, the industrial section in the northwest part of the city was on the other far side of the Taedong River from the mountains which lay to the east, and would involve the risk of crossing the bridge. I was wondering what to do about that when Cousin Lin continued, "I think I can get you some money." After every bombing, he explained, the communists printed paper bills in great quantity, then went around with trucks, hastily settling their accounts with suppliers. They hoped that by putting money in circulation, they'd give a boost to shattered morale. I volunteered to help with the moving so that the other men would get to know me, and the guards would take my presence as a matter of course. All of Pyongyang appeared to be streaming out of the city. The refugees were a heart-rending sight, staggering along with whatever they could carry lashed to their A-frames, but their numbers so harried the guards at either end that they waved our truck along with only the most casual glance at my engineer's certificate. I stayed that day to help get the machinery in place. That night we slept again on the factory floor in the open spaces between the huge lash lathes and drills. My nerves were so shattered, and I was so tired that I fell asleep easily. About the middle of the night, I suddenly awoke. At first, I didn't know where I was. As I raised myself up on one elbow, I saw a phalanx of large, strange shapes towering over me. In my tense state, I didn't recognize them as machines under their shrouds. They were the quintessence of all my fears. Relentless phantoms bent on my destruction. They were coming at me. As I stared spellbound, one of the shapes took on the features of Chung Bong Shun, only swollen to street poster size, such as those of Stalin and Kim Il-sung that one saw everywhere. Now the face was moving, coming down, closing in. I wanted to cry out, but I kept still, lest I disturb the sleeping men. Then there came to me a half-forgotten bit of old Korean lore, which went something like this. If one is lying prone and wakes up in the middle of the night to see strange shapes looming above him, at first they will appear smaller than life, but if one continues to stare, they will grow even larger.
come closer and closer until, hypnotized, one feels helpless before them. But if one can rise from his position, climb up on something until he can look down upon the threatening objects, they'll shrink back into their true proportions and will no longer threaten. In the moonlight, streaming in through a barred window not far from me, I saw a workman's high stool. Persuaded by the wisdom of this ancient council, I climbed until I could stand on the stool and look down upon my surroundings. The objects of my fears became again what they were in fact, ordinary machines under shapeless shrouds. I didn't get down from my stool at once, but remained there thinking. If this council had worked so well in subduing the terrors of this night, why wouldn't it help in subduing the fears that dogged me constantly? My terrors would disappear if only I were able to look down upon them from some height. A notion which had long been nagging at me suddenly crystallized into firm purpose. I would leave Pyongyang and go straight up to my beloved mountain at the far end of Koksan. There, I was sure, I'd be able to get my life in perspective once more. Having made up my mind, I returned to my mochkin and was soon fast asleep. The next morning, Cousin Lin called to me and drew me into a dark corner. Clutched in his fist, I saw a pile of crisp new bills. He counted out a stack of them, 100,000 Korean won in all. I had no words to thank him. The amount was far more than I had expected, but I would need every bit of it. With the pack in full cry, I couldn't approach anyone else that I knew. Cousin Lin did not ask for a receipt, but I gave him one, telling him that Father would redeem it when Cousin Lin returned to Mangjo-ri. I went into the factory toilet and carefully fitted the bills into the empty money belt around my waist. There were so many that I had to overlap them. I didn't want the bulge to be conspicuous. I also put a few of the bills in my trousers for emergency use. I bade Cousin Lin a fond goodbye, thanked him once more, and left. Now for the mountain. By waiting until the day shift of factory workers flooded over the bridge at once, and again I got by without trouble, but it did make me feel uneasy to be back in this part of Pyongyang. True, since I had fled from Mr. Park's, we had undergone one of the worst bombings of the war, causing large-scale evacuation, chaos, and confusion. Maybe the communists had forgotten about me. On the other hand, the police now had in their possession both my identity card and the constitution of the underground. I was no longer a mere suspect. Perhaps I imagined it, but the police seemed to be everywhere. I slunk into an alley, keeping to back byways until I should find some refuge. I had left without breakfast. I was getting hungry. Not far ahead, I saw the tall cloth sign announcing a Chinese restaurant. The last two characters in such signs are always the same, signifying a meal store, while the first character denotes the owner's name. Here I could eat in private, for in a Chinese restaurant, each table is placed in a separate room. Korean restaurants, on the other hand, are usually open because the customers like to eat sitting on the floor around low tables as they do at home. I was relieved to see that it had a rear door through which I could escape if necessary. Korean restaurants have only one door. Patrons must leave their shoes in pigeonholes as they enter. Also, Chinese restaurants were seldom disturbed by the communists, for they were little patronized by Koreans, and the communists appeared willing to leave the Chinese to themselves. I ordered some melon soup, deep-fried beef with water chestnuts and bamboo shoots, and some warm noodles. Korean restaurants serve cool noodles. It's a popular dish. The restaurant was not far from the thoroughfare leading to the northbound highway, but I needed a good night's sleep before I started. I remembered another small houseook which was nearby, and when I had finished my supper, I sought it out. I went to bed as soon as it grew dark because I was anxious to be on my way as early as possible. I awoke with a start to see a pale blue light filtering in through the dirty windows of my room. I was on my feet in a panic, fearing I had overslept. I ought to be clear of the slums and far beyond the railroad station and the industrial section before the morning air raid sirens started howling around 10 o'clock. Hastily climbing into my trousers and shirt, I went down the corridor and out through a door that opened on an alley. I had gone only a little way when I realized that the light was not daylight. It was coming from the moon. I stared at my empty wrist. What a nuisance that I'd left my watch. I had no idea what time it was. I was trying to make up my mind whether to go back or keep on when a heavy footstep resounded hollowly behind me. Stop! I turned and faced the man who had accosted me. As I had expected, he was a uniformed police officer. Who are you? Where are you going? Don't you know you're in violation of curfew, being out this hour of the night?
What time is it?
4 o'clock in the morning. I tried to explain my mistake, but he wouldn't listen. Without further discussion, we walked 3 blocks to the small neighborhood station house. 7 other curfew violators were already in the room. The lieutenant asked for my identity card. I gave him my engineer's certificate instead and pretended to keep on searching for it. The lieutenant put the certificate in a drawer without reading it. My captor plumped me down on a hard wooden bench. Because I was the last one in, I had the seat closest to the lieutenant's desk. Then everyone apparently forgot me. Other policemen came in with other violators. By 5 o'clock, the room had become quite crowded. An inspector in plain clothes elbowed his way up to the desk and threw a circular with a large photograph down in front of the lieutenant. "Take a good look at that son of a dog," said the inspector. "He's still on the loose. We're told to bring him in." "What'd he do?" asked the lieutenant without much interest. "He's planning to blow up all of Pyongyang, and us with it, that's all," said the inspector. "He's the boss of the underground." The lieutenant, mildly interested now, swiveled around in his chair and held up the circular in the narrow beam of light from his desk lamp. On it was my picture. I broke out in a cold sweat. A big knot formed in my stomach as I watched the two of them studying it together. I was thankful for my heavy glasses, my shaggy hair, and for the fact that I was thinner. I could only hope that my appearance had changed enough so they wouldn't recognize me. The telephone rang. The lieutenant answered. He handed the receiver to the inspector, who listened, grunted once or twice, and hung up. "Maybe we've got him," he said. "They're holding some guy over at the next station house who answers his description." He stuffed the circular into his pocket and went out. A few minutes later, another police officer came on duty to relieve the man at the desk, which could mean only that the curfew must be ended. At the first opportunity, I went to the desk and explained my mistake. "I haven't had the chance to tell anyone that I've got some urgent business for the party in Koksan. If you'll overlook my error this time, I'll gladly pay the fine." A gleam of cupidity came into his eyes. He muttered something and handed me a receipt already made out for the fine. It was for twice the posted amount. I took the bills from my trouser pocket and counted out the exact sum and even added some more. The lieutenant reached greedily for the money. He counted the bills under his breath. Satisfied at last, he put his hand in a drawer and gave me back my engineer's certificate. The sun was up. I stole a glance at the watch on the relief officer's wrist, 6:00. If I was to get beyond the danger zone before the air raid warning sounded, I'd better be starting. Well, that was the end of chapter 8. The next time, chapter 9 will be the name given to the book also, Decision at Dawn, evidently the key chapter of the book coming up. If you'd like a fuller introduction to this book,
I would like you to go to my homepage here at Sermon Audio. There's a blog toward the top of the page with the same name as the book, Decision at Dawn. If you click on the blog, you'll get a little more detail about the author and the contents of the book. Be sure to look for chapters 1 to 7, by the way, that are already on. This site, sermonaudio.com/aservant70 and chosenhouse.com are dedicated to the Word of God and to informing people's prayer life about North Korea. The story that I'm reading happened 60 years ago, but it's just a little of what's happening now in North Korea. So I'm reading it in hopes that you will get it in your heart to pray daily, constantly, regularly for God's people, your brothers, your sisters in Christ in that far-off land. May God have His way in your life too and in mine as we seek God's will together. God bless you today.